Good evening. I'm Kilowatt 2 Romeo India Whiskey, and this is the technical net on Landmark. You'll also hear Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee, Mel. And my name is Dick. So Mel and Dick try to act as net control and moderator and coordinator and interlocutor of this wild and enthusiastic crowd that meet here each Sunday evening for most of 4 hours and sometimes beyond these days to discuss their favorite subject, radio, wireless equipment, how it works, how to make it work better, how to understand it. The schools don't do a good enough job of teaching that subject. Mel, Dick, and their friends try to help out in that area. This particular repeater covers, to some degree, northeastern New Jersey, southern New York State, and southwestern Connecticut. So within that area, there's an awful lot of brain power. And the TechNet tries to coordinate that brain power, bring it to, apply it to people's individual questions and problems and desire for understanding. Quite often what will happen is somebody brings in a question. Somebody from New Jersey or New York or Connecticut says, I know something about that. He chimes in and gives us the benefit of his wisdom. That's pretty much how it works. TAM's helping each other. We just sort of gather the clan and try to make it all happen. The philosophy of the net is that there is no question that's too dumb a question. So don't worry about that. If you think you've got a question that doesn't quite come up to the level of technology of some of the questions you hear, don't let that scare you. Also, don't be disappointed by the fact that sometimes you get real deep into a subject and all kinds of fancy vocabulary is flowing, and don't let that put you off. The process of learning new equipment, new knowledge, is always like that. It's uncomfortable at first.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And try to wait 2 or 3 seconds beyond the beep each time to make sure all of the system gets reset properly, so that the people who are out of the area using IRLP or Echo Link or whatever are also able to join us if they desire. But what I was starting to say is that if some of the information you hear is uncomfortable, don't let that turn you off. Because by the time you hear something a few times, it'll eventually start making sense. In theory, a person could learn Chinese language by being dropped in the middle of China and staying there for a year with no real instruction, just by listening and paying attention. He'll learn it. And some of the knowledge that people pick up with ham radio is in a similar manner. So don't let that turn you off. And tonight we'll be discussing later on some of the information that's been requested quite often about how do you understand all of these crazy terms on the rating sheets for a receiver or a transmitter, the product review. How do you understand all of those? We found a beautiful website that helps somewhat. I didn't say it's going to make it easy, but gives you an awful lot of good information. We'll be discussing that. We also have a little bit of a puzzle tonight. For a couple of weeks now, we were hearing about a dipole made out of stainless steel wire that was not working. And so we'd like you guys to tell us what you think it is. Because as you'll find out, it's sort of an interesting story. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your name, the call letters, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this: Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Zulu, Bob, and yes. And Bob is one of the guys we'll be signing in tonight. We also have Joe.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You ain't supposed to do that. Only twice now. When you do get a chance to talk, watch like I wasn't doing, and after a minute or a minute and a quarter, make sure you drop the machine and wait a second or two beyond the beep. We do have a holdover from last week. Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, wants to bring a question to our attention that he didn't get a chance to last week. So, please give me your call letters and name at this time. And that word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW, TechNet Landmark. We're listening.
November, Wesley, yes.
Okay, we had a double. I heard Wesley. Who was the other person?
W-A-2,
Victor David Henry. John, yes.
KC2SYL, Bill, no.
Good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
WS2N, Paul? No, at this time, but good evening, Dick.
And Paul, will you have a report for us tonight on what NASA is doing?
I just have two items, really, but that's it. Not much, but we'll be standing by, Dick, in case somebody has a question relating to the topic of space and science. Back to Dick.
Very fine, Paul. Nothing wrong with having a report that's shorter than usual. Not to worry. There's an amazing number of people who would like to know a little bit more about astronomy, space, astrophysics, what NASA is doing, and so on. So you provide an exciting part of the show for some people. So far we've got Wesley, John, Bill, Mel. I haven't yet heard from Joe or Bob, but anyone else to check in, give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes if you've got a question or a comment at this time. K2RIW listening.
KB2,
BBS, Freddy, Joe. WH1YY, I'm listening, yes.
Okay, that time we got Freddy and Joe, and one last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2SWB, Martin, yes.
Very fine, Martin. Was that Kilo, Bravo 2, Sierra, Whiskey, Bravo? Go ahead.
That was Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Whiskey Bravo, and I'm on the Eastern input.
Very fine, Martin. Kilo Charlie 2. We got you this time. Somehow I heard it incorrectly. Okay. First person who signed in was Wesley, N2XJN. How are things doing in Queens tonight, Wesley? K2RIW listening.
K2RIW and the group of people listening. This is November to X-ray Juliet November. I'm doing very good. I have a few things just to ask the general public of the ham radio operators and you. I'm in the process of completing my laboratory. So far I have 16 pieces. There are a few quite good that I'm very proud about it, and Tektronics. Oscilloscope, the Kikuchi oscilloscope. Sencor is absolutely gorgeous. The LC-102 capacitor inductor analyzer. And stuff from the vintage one, from the good one, Hewlett Packard spectral voltmeter probe, and the generator up to 1 gigahertz. Anyhow, my question is. What is the difference between resistance box and a voltage divider? I'm talking about resistance box with the switches, like the old style in the wooden boxes, or then make it later in the metal box. And the voltage divider, both of them are switchable resistors. The second question is, what is the difference between the series of 600 oscilloscope and 700 of the oscilloscope of Hewlett-Packard, like 654C or 754D, let's say? And the third question, vacuum tube voltmeter, which I have one, actually, the HP410, let's say, I have much better one, big one, and the true RMS meter, what is the difference between them? Back to you, Dick, and to XJM.
Very fine. I'm going to answer some of those in reverse order. In the case of the Hewlett-Packard 410 vacuum tube voltmeter, I'm pretty sure I've used some of those in the past. I think it comes with an RF probe, as well as the normal probes that will allow you to measure AC voltage, DC voltage. I'm not sure whether or not it measures current, but probably it does. And the actual scale on the meter reads out volts. In the case of AC volts, I think it reads AC volts, and it says the word RMS. And there's an extremely big difference between RMS and true RMS. when you're working with anything that is not a pure sine wave. A pure sine wave plugged into a vacuum tube voltmeter becomes rectified. The rectified voltage gets applied to a meter. The meter is an averaging device. So it comes up with the average voltage of the rectified sine wave. Let me drop. And a rectified sine wave has a voltage average that is 63% of peak. And the meter recognizes that the calibration, the guy who designed the meter, calibrated it in such a way that when AC voltage of 63% goes in there, it reads out on its scale 70.7%, which is RMS. In other words, the conversion between average and RMS, they're taking that into account for you on the assumption that everything you put into the meter is a pure sine wave when you're on the AC scale. Because of that conversion, there's a kind of an error built in whenever you're measuring a non-sinusoidal wave. If you're measuring a wave that has a high crest factor, in other words, it's got a high peak-to-valley voltage ratio, let me drop. I should say peak to average or peak to RMS ratio, then a true RMS meter, what it must literally do at every instant of time is take the input waveform and square it, average it, and then take the square root of the result. That's what true RMS stands for. RMS, true RMS, really means it'll take any waveform up to a particular frequency and up to a particular crest factor of voltage and give you the real heating value. In other words, once you know the RMS voltage of some arbitrary sinusoidal or non-sinusoidal waveform, that waveform, that voltage applied to a known resistor creates a known amount of heating. True RMS does that. So particularly where that comes into effect would be if you were running some of those rotary machinery with magnets, neodymium iron magnets that are shown on some of those YouTube videos, where a few of them measure what they think is power input and power output, but they were using ordinary Dawson-Val movement type meters to measure input voltage and input current. And it turns out that when you've got a saturating core or a partially saturating core of a rotary magnetic machine, and then you're using the inductive kickback coming back out of the machine into some kind of a rectifier, you have very non-sinusoidal voltages. Therefore, what you think is the power going in and what you think is the power coming back out, you can easily develop as much as 50% of error. Therefore, you can easily think you're getting 50% gain in power out of a rotary machine with that kind of instrumentation. If you were using true RMS instrumentation, measuring...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If you were using true RMS instrumentation to measure input voltage and current, or a true RMS wattmeter, which takes the instantaneous product of voltage and current and comes up with the real power, including the so-called phase angle difference between the two, the power factor, then you'd be able to really measure the amount of energy you're putting into the machine and the amount of energy coming back out. And you do that and you'll start coming up with very different numbers. So I'm reasonably convinced that a number of those YouTube videos showing an apparent gain in the excess power coming out, we're really running into an instrumentation problem. So true RMS is something that's very desirable. It's a little bit more expensive. You can buy digital multimeters these days that have true RMS capability. It probably makes the price go 50% or maybe even 100% higher on that digital multimeter. But in many cases, it's worth it. When it comes to the Hewlett-Packard 654C oscilloscope and 754 Delta oscilloscope, let's hope that somebody has some familiarity with those. If not, maybe there's going to be some websites. Quite often, if you Google those particular words, you'll find at first various companies that are selling them. Let me drop. And hopefully you'll eventually find somebody who will give you an explanation for one of their properties. Some of the websites that are a little hard to find, you can actually find Tektronix and Hewlett-Packard operators' manuals and service manuals for those individual pieces of instrumentation, which will really give you all of the performance requirements or the performance capability. And that's kind of nice to have. So if anyone within the sound of my voice has familiarity with Hewlett Packard 654 Charlie or 754 Delta, please chime in when I finally quiet down. When it comes to the difference between a voltage divider network made out of resistors or a resistor box, I've got a couple of opinions I'm going to express on that one, and hopefully some other people come along and give them further evidence of that. I've seen a kind of resistor box where it is a made out of high power resistors, and you can dial in how much load you want to put onto a power supply. So if you just made yourself a particular power supply with a particular regulator circuit built in, let me drop. It's nice to be able to put various loads on that power supply while measuring the droop and output voltage and ripple and whatever on your oscilloscope or on your true RMS voltmeter, and therefore find out how good is the regulation under various load conditions. There's one kind of resistor box like that. There's another kind of precision voltage divider network that's used for calibrating instruments. Quite often the so-called standards laboratory within a good company will have a particular device which is putting out a known amount of voltage, and you compare the voltage you read with that device compared to the various scales of your digital multimeter that you're calibrating as you put in various voltages, and by way of the resistor divider network, you keep coming back to the comparison voltage, your standard voltage, on the divider network. And if the divider network has enough precision, you can therefore rate the accuracy of the various scales of your vacuum tube voltmeter or digital multimeter that you're calibrating. So that's one other kind of a precision voltage divider network. There also are kinds of resistor networks that work up to, in one case, the Hewlett-Packard, I can't think of the model number now, of a switchable network, which always has 50 ohms input and 50 ohms output, and you can dial in 1 dB steps from 0 to 70 decibels. The first version they came out with that thing had BNC connectors on it and worked up to 1 gigahertz. Let me drop. They now make various versions that are either remotely programmable by a computer, or they have local dials on them, which have either a precision SMA connector or other kinds of connectors on them, and they work up to frequencies like 18 gigahertz, and you can dial in 1 dB steps, sometimes a fraction of a dB steps, all the way up to numbers like 70 decibels. So there are kinds of resistor coaxial. From the outside world, they look like the coaxial. You look with a microscope inside, and there are precision resistor divider networks built onto glass substrates with precision little switching devices that throw them in and throw them out. And some of these are quite expensive. I had one of those in my hand one time, and I was using it to make a precision measurement as to how strong was the signal coming in 2 meters on my antenna into a standard receiver. I made the mistake of leaving the darn thing dialed in and transmitting back through it. And most of these are rated for something like 1 watt maximum. And I poured 30 watts through the darn thing and burned it up in a couple of seconds. And it was an extremely expensive device, very hard for me to repair, because Hewlett-Packard doesn't sell you those individual replaceable items inside. That's a factory repair, and all kinds of recalibration is required. So there's lots and lots of ways of getting resistor divider networks. Now, if anyone has any further information for Wesley, please give me your call letters at this time. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. As far as the Hewlett-Packard true RMS meters, the difference in the instruments is how high in range they'll go as far as frequency goes. They also come with a calibration chart telling you, for instance, that if you're measuring, say, between, let me think offhand, what the deviation in the reading, the percentage of reading deviation is, and then it would go to the next range, and they keep giving you the deviation that you have to, in other words, there's a logging system that they use to give you way of compensating for the different frequency that you're using to make the measurement as on their true RMS beams. Dick, let me let it drop.
What I think you're referring to, Mel, is the fact that in order to make a digital multimeter or a vacuum tube voltmeter or any other kind of a voltage AC measuring instrument really display true RMS, internally it must take the instantaneous voltage you're putting into it and square it, and then go through a mathematical process. I think in some cases it's done with a kind of an operational amplifier circuit, and there's probably other ways of doing it, but obviously they all have a limit as to what is the instantaneous peak voltage they can tolerate on each individual scale, and what also is the highest frequency they can go to and still accurately square the voltage instantaneously and come up with the right reading. So it's nice to have a meter that's true RMS. It gives you a hell of a lot more accuracy on non-sinusoidal waveforms. But don't make the mistake, as Mel is indicating to us, don't make the mistake of assuming that it's always going to tell you true RMS. You may be putting in there, for instance, a two-tone test from a single sideband transmitter at 144 megacycles, and you'd like to know the true RMS power coming out of that transmitter after you're sampling it with, say, a directional coupler that's connected to an antenna, and you're taking a 30 dB or 40 dB attenuated sample, and you'd like to believe that the two-tone test true RMS power can be measured by your particular multimeter, and whether or not it's rated at that frequency for that peak envelope power for that particular waveform is something you'd have to worry about a little bit. Most likely the answer is more accurate than without using a true RMS meter, but like everything else, it has limitations. As Clint Eastwood said, a man's got to know his limitations. What if there's something else you would like to add to that, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW, in the tech net.
Do not.
Mel, before you get into this, another piece of equipment is the Hewlett Packard HP8405A. It's a vector voltmeter. This is absolutely amazing stuff. I have actually put the HP652A, the test oscillator, 1.8 megahertz, and I was able to dip that vector voltmeter. I love this machine. But back to you, Mel, and to Jim.
WA2VDH with a comment. Okay, let's see if I got it. Eight. Do I have a stick?
You sure do. Go ahead. Then we'll pick up John right after you.
Okay. You asked also about the scope. Well, the individual scopes, I'm not that familiar with all the Hewlett Packard scopes. I've dealt with a few of the Hewlett Packard scopes, and I can't really, I'm trying to think of the ones that you're talking about. I'm more familiar with the Tektronix. However, one more thing I was going to bring up, and that is some voltage decade and system boxes. There are a number of them that are very good piece of equipment for calibration that are on the market, and I'm trying to think of the standard. They call it standard and calibration equipment, and one of the companies that is very popular that was making a lot of that was General Radio. So if you can find it, they called it the resistance standard or resistance decade. Excellent instrument. Also, there was another company also making very similar instruments, they make, well, I should say General Radio made a number of them, you know, basically resistance decades, ratio transformer systems, what the heck else, I could think of a number of them, I just couldn't remember what they looked like, capacitors, decades, all General Radio deck over.
General Radio and Fluke, and let's see, there's another brand name. Some of these precision decade resistor boxes are good for calibrating the ohmmeter scale, calibrating the voltage scale, by doing a comparison test. There's also a kind of a Wheatstone bridge that was being used for a whole lot of years to make either a resistor standard or a capacitor or inductor standard. When it comes to the Hewlett-Packard 8405 vector voltmeter, I use that one. It's got two very sensitive probes that are used in what looks like a kind of a directional coupler or a kind of a T-connector, and therefore you can probe two different portions of an RF circuit, and it will give you with extreme accuracy the voltage amplitude difference or the voltage phase difference between those two test points. And so that can be a very handy machine. You can also use it in such a way where you're measuring the forward voltage and the reverse voltage on directional couplers on a transmission line. The vector voltmeter, which goes up to 1 gigahertz, and it's got a kind of, it's got a kind of a phase lock loop set up inside. It happens to beat everything down to a 60 kilohertz IF frequency internally. And there are people who would open up the cabinet of the machine, dig into the 60 kilohertz IF circuits, in order to use that instrument to make a precision measurement of group delay distortion as they sweep across that particular frequency range. Eventually, Hewlett-Packard came out with instrumentation that was intended directly to do that. The vector voltmeter really was a kind of a predecessor to what is now called a vector network analyzer. The vector voltmeter did not contain a signal generator. You had to supply the signal generator, and it had these two probes, and it would measure, up to 60 dB of difference between the voltage on the two probes while measuring the phase difference.
The meter, the old one, Q-meter, does have two of them.
I'll take your word for it that the Q-meter had two vector voltmeters. Wow. But the vector network analyzer, the advantage it has is that it's got a signal generator built in as well as a vector voltmeter. It does make a forward and reverse measurement. So by modern day standards, a vector network analyzer is a little more useful than a vector voltmeter was, but they're both very good instruments. John from A2VDH, go right ahead with your information for Wesley, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine business. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about two RMS digital meters. Quite a few of the, especially the Fluke meters, they would give in the AC position the RMS of the AC portion of the waveform. So if you had a waveform that had DC plus AC on it, you would first take a DC measurement, then switch to AC and get the RMS of the AC portion, and then do a square root of the sum of the squares to get the true RMS or total RMS. And I know we have quite a few of those Fluke multimeters up at school, and that's one of the characteristics with them, FactNet.
Do you believe, John, that that Fluke meter you're describing, when it's measuring first the DC and then the AC, that's similar to the old volt-ohm milliamp meters, there was a way of making a measurement through a coupling capacitor that was internal to the instrument. You could have an AC coupled scale, which would remove the DC component and measure what's left over as the AC component. Do you believe the Fluke did something similar to that? Over to you, John.
Dick, I think what they did is their squaring circuit in there could not handle DC. It seemed to be deliberately blocked. They had a blocking capacitor in there, but their AC position or their squaring circuit would not seem to handle, could not handle any DC at all. So they let you take the measurement separately, and you had to do that square root sum of the squares thing. Go ahead.
There we go. If you guys remember the Hitchkit Q-meter, the old one, that's a beautiful machine. It had a generator that you could set the frequency, and it had the analyzing circuit that you could set to the resonance. Back to the...
Yeah, I've never used a Q-meter very much, although I've seen them. They were in the adjacent department from where I was working. One of the things that I want to give you some warning about, Wesley, don't fall into the mistake that I made twice. One day I wanted to take my digital multimeter, and very carefully I was going to very slowly turn my Wimhurst machine, which is capable of putting out numbers like 100,000 volts. I wanted to watch the needle slowly rise as I began turning that meter, turning that Wimhurst machine, in order to measure the voltage in a digital voltmeter. And the digital voltmeter never moved. That particular one never moved again. So it turns out that the good news about some of these modern-day digital multimeters is they've got an input impedance of 10 million ohms. They create very light loading on a circuit, and that's a huge difference compared to the old-fashioned triplet and Simpson-type digital, volt-ohm millimeter. They produced a loading of 20,000 ohms per volt. In other words, the one-volt scale, if there was one, would be a 20,000-ohm load. And that's a big difference compared to a 10-megohm load. The meter would load things down when you're trying to measure voltage. An AGC voltage, which is a megohm-type voltage or a multi-megohm voltage impedance that's on a receiver, you can't measure that with an old-fashioned volt-ohm millimeter. But with a modern-day digital multimeter, the 10-megohm input impedance, when it drops, you can make that measurement. That's the good news. The bad news is that because its impedance is so high, you can have the machine, you can have your digital multimeter 5 feet away from the high voltage circuit you're experimenting with. You're not aware of it, but your high voltage circuit, like my Wimhurst machine or my Van de Graaff generator, and in your case maybe it's going to be a Tesla coil, it's emitting ions into the air that you're not aware of. Some of those ions are moving like a cloud across your laboratory airspace. 5 feet away, they manage to land on the leads of your digital multimeter, which isn't even turned on. And the next day, you go and turn your digital multimeter on, and you realize that it's got a blown front end, and replacing that can be a pain. So when you're doing high voltage experiments with local high, extremely high impedance metering nearby, be careful. You might want to put it in a shielded box. You might want to put it into another laboratory somewhere else away. Don't make the mistake I did. I've done it twice. My favorite true RMS digital multimeter, made by the Tesla company, I think it is. Tesla's. I've forgotten the brand name. It's got a nice yellow case, and I'm going through a very difficult process of troubleshooting it. A smarter man than me would just write down another check for $230 to buy a new true RMS digital multimeter. I want to fix the one that I just damaged. I've done it twice in a row now, so when you're working around high voltage and you've got high impedance metering, be careful. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you very much for your very much valuable input also. The rest of the people, I enjoy the TechNet and the people gathering in here and all of your comments. I remember from the old time, the model B1G, there was M-frame, because it doesn't exist any longer, there was the miniature high voltage divider. And that divider was actually made to play with the 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 volts. And the question of mine, I understood that the digital voltmeter, the true RMS voltmeter, it is sensitive even if it's not switched off to the ionization of the air. How about the old tube VTVM meters, like that the one that I said, HP410B, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, as you and I, who, or at least some of the guys who have worked on defensive electronics, found out in a very painful way, when your instrumentation became vacuum tubes, the good news is that you can have input impedances of many megohms. That creates very light loading. Another piece of good news is that vacuum tubes are extremely rugged. You could put in kilovolts across that control grid. As long as it's backed up with a high enough impedance, you can put kilovolts across that control grid of a vacuum tube, and it will survive. You do that with a solid-state device, and boy, they get damaged real fast. And so one of the things that we were very concerned about at one time, when you're building electronic countermeasures circuitry, is that we in the Western world favored miniaturized, efficient, solid-state circuits. And much of the Eastern Bloc nations used vacuum tube circuits. And there's an extreme advantage they had when it comes to electromagnetic pulse and high voltage survivability. So a vacuum tube voltmeter that really contains vacuum tubes, all of the damage I'm talking about probably does not occur. They're immune. So look out with your digital multimeter, particularly a true RMS type digital multimeter, modern one. Even 5 feet away is not safe enough. That ionic cloud that's made by your high voltage circuit you're experimenting with can kill the thing even though it's turned off and a long distance away with its leads wrapped around the case. In my case, I've done it now twice, and I've learned some very painful lessons. Okay, good luck with all that instrumentation you're gathering. Sounds like you're setting up a real nice laboratory there, Wesley. And we'll go back to your circuit. We'll go back to your subject after we go through the other people that are on the list right now. The next person who signed in was Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y. And what would you like to bring to our attention tonight, Joe? K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, if you read my email and looked at the pictures, what kind of antenna is being displayed in the pictures?
First of all, your email strongly recommended that we drop for 3 seconds after the beep. Yeah, the four-wire or five-wire antenna that's on the western side of the 135 Parkway, I think it is, south of the Lorham Expressway, which is, I believe you speculated that that is, or you already know that that is part of a beacon, marker beacon, for the airport in Farmingdale. And the wire antenna is very similar to that kind of antenna that was used by that Scandinavian group that transmits a signal that's something like 100 kilohertz. Can't think of the guy's name now. You probably know the name. It's a rotary machine that actually generates the radio wave that gets transmitted into this, let's call it a top hat antenna. A very large, long, highly mounted group of wires, quite often fed in the center. It's a kind of a top hat loaded monopole fed in the center with quite often one single wire, and the transmitter operates between that wire and ground, and the top hat capacity set up. And that's a kind of antenna used for very low frequencies, in the hundreds of kilohertz quite often, and sometimes even lower. The other red antenna that looks sort of like a corner reflector, I couldn't see quite enough of it to really make sense of it. I wonder if you've got a guess on that one, Joe. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
I already know what that one is. The one that's, yeah, I know, I just went to the beep. Hopefully it's the IRL thing. That other antenna operates at about 75 megahertz. That's a completely different type of system, but if it's the one with the long wires, I was kind of curious. So, now, what do they actually call that type of antenna that's spread like that? Because I've never seen that type of installation before. And they are about 400, 380 to 400 kilohertz if that station transmits on, something like that.
There probably is a fancy name for it. I call it a top hat capacitor. It is really a shrunken down monopole. In theory, there's a counterpoise structure in the ground. You've got these suspended wires above the ground, parallel to the ground. You've got the single wire in the center feeding the whole thing. So when it comes to very low frequency antennas, by our standards, that's one way of feeding it. I think some of the very early Marconi antennas operated by that exact principle. And in his case, they were a spark gap transmitter. So I don't know the name right now, but I'm going to try to find it out for you. That rotary machine that they use in Scandinavia that they turn on once every couple of years, which puts out a signal, I forget what frequency it was on, 60 kilohertz, 100 kilohertz. A few of the guys stateside will build a simple loop-like antenna in order to listen to that. And it propagates, it literally uses the ionosphere and the ground as a kind of a waveguide when you're down to those low frequencies. Let me drop. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find that the Loran antenna has some similarity to that. There's also an antenna that was used for communicating with submarines, which worked at these very low frequencies. When you go to a low enough frequency and a high enough number of kilowatts with a big enough antenna, you can transmit a very slow signal to a submarine anywhere in the world that's up to 60 kilohertz below seawater. You simply drag a wire behind that submarine, connect it to the right kind of a receiver, and it will pick up that signal. Even though the wire is in a very conductive medium called salt water, and the wire is being dragged 60 feet below the surface, some of those antennas actually float up to the surface. Some of them stay below the surface while they're in operation. So there are some advantages to those super low frequencies. There's some strong disadvantages also. Lightning can really create havoc at those frequencies. And the lightning storm that's giving the grief might be half a world away. So I think there's a section of the antenna engineering handbook that covers those antennas. I vaguely remember seeing a diagram of one of those, Joe. Now back to you, Joe. To be 2RYY, K2RYW.
Hey, Alex Anderson, alternator.
That's the name I was looking for. Please pronounce that one more time. Alex Anderson or something like that, alternator. Go ahead, is that the right one?
Yep, I believe that's it. WB2QG, second inning.
That's correct.
Thank you for that one, Bill. Bill, I wonder if you've ever listened to those super low frequencies. And when you do, the strange thing is that a simple loop of wire with multiple turns to it that you resonate, it's very important, and properly oriented, when you're on those super low frequencies, whether the loop is 1 foot in diameter or 14 feet in diameter, almost doesn't matter if you have a sensitive enough receiver. Just the fact that it resonates and it picks up the local H field, not the E field, it favors the H field, and so those guys over in Scandinavia can turn on that alternator machine of theirs. It's a rotary machine with a whole lot of poles to it, rotating about as fast as they can go without it flying apart, putting out tens of kilohertz signals. So I wonder if you or if you know of anyone else on Long Island who's done some of that listening and how successful was it. WB2QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, good evening again. I'm not going to hold it to too long. I'm in a crappy spot. One of my brother-in-laws has tried it and heard it. I don't know how successful he was down here. I know he did it upstate and was able to hear it. And you're right, the actual diameter of the loop doesn't seem to matter. It's just getting into a quiet enough, an atmospherically quiet enough spot, or it's actually a QRM quiet enough spot without all kinds of arcing and sparking appliances. WB2QGZ, thank you.
Comment.
Very fine, Bill, thank you. A person with a comment, wait for the beep and go right ahead.
Yeah, I'll check in same time, WFTW, nothing to ask. Just wanted to add, some versions of it may be called different. Alex Anderson, HF alternator.
Okay, you said you call letters so fast, I wasn't sure. It sounded like Whiskey Foxtrot 2 Whiskey. Was that your call letter, sir?
Anthony, W2W, alternator.
Alrighty, thank you for that information. One of the things that's really kind of strange is that what is the most ideal antenna for transmitting or receiving on each individual frequency region changes tremendously. What Marconi was using in his day, what we use at higher frequencies these days, and as you go to even higher frequencies and you start using optical techniques, quasi-optical techniques, the design of the antenna changes an awful lot. A skilled person looking at a photograph of an antenna, in many cases, can make a pretty good estimation as to what frequency range the antenna is intended for. You go to that website, which shows you the so-called woodpecker antenna, which was in the Soviet Union. This thing was an array of dipoles that I think the array was in the vicinity of 300 feet high and probably 600 feet wide, an array of dipoles on this over-the-horizon radar. My goodness, is that an antenna. Love to know what the gain of that thing is. And by way of the photographs, I think you could estimate the size of the things and come up with some pretty good estimations of the numbers. And for a while, that was giving some of the guys on HF frequencies quite a bit of grief. It's now not in operation. Okay, back to you, Joe. WA2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. I guess you called. What type of antenna did you call that? I'm curious of how that actually seems to work. You called it a monopole type of antenna. So the top part, the radiating wire going up, and the horizontal elements that are all connected together with some sort of shorting bar It's actually one half the antenna, and it really requires a good counterpoise to the other side of that to actually get that to work properly at that frequency.
There, I'm not sure, Joe. There is the possibility that the multiple wires that are up in the air, all strapped together in the center and sometimes on the ends, are themselves a resonant circuit. And you're feeding that at a high voltage point in the center with that simple wire going back down. In which case, the amount of counterpoise below it wouldn't be quite as important if it resonates in that manner. And the Alexanderson alternator, I think, uses that mode of operation. So the antenna itself, the thing that's parallel to the ground, all of those wires, that may itself be a resonant circuit. So it might not be a top hat loaded monopole, even though it physically looks like it could be. Because if it was, you shrink it down that much. In order for it to be efficient, the extreme amount of counterpoise wires in the ground would be required. If it is a resonant circuit all by itself, and you're feeding it something like a Carolina Windham, which it's feeding it at a resonant voltage point, so to speak, with a single wire in one of the embodiments, then the amount of counterpoise is nowhere near as required. It's a resonant circuit, and you're just exciting it at a favorable location. I'm going to have to do a little more digging on that one, Joe. As you can tell, I'm not sure. And we'll find out as time goes on. Maybe other people will sign and give us some information on that. The next person on our list was John, WA2VDH, Whiskey Alpha 2 Victor Delta Hotel, if I got it right. Go right ahead, John. What would you like to talk about?
Okay, fine. This is, a couple of comments. First of all, as far as the low-frequency reception, we have the old RBA-5 receiver sitting out in the garage. It weighs half a ton, and one of these days they're going to fire it back up again. Got that on Canal Street years ago. My question was about third-order intercept and also a comment on Mel's experiment from last week. In third-order intercept, where you're graphing the third-order terms, are those third-order terms all of the third-order intermod terms, the 2F2 plus or minus F1, 2F1 plus or minus F2, or are they just the close-in third-order terms? Oh, let me drop. Or are they just one of the third-order intermod terms? I'm a little confused about the graph when they do the third-order intercept, what exactly they are graphing as part of the third-order terms. My other comment was on that experiment that Mel was talking about last week with the 3-to-1 SWR. If you get a chance later on, maybe you could describe that again, because I think that can be verified by doing a component sweep with that 25-ohm resistor. Anyway, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I hope we do iron out the details of that very nice way of doing it, if we can make it work accurately. It's just adding a 25-ohm resistor, sweeping or not sweeping, and eventually figuring out exactly what the impedance of your antenna is, if you're smart enough in the way you read the instrumentation. Now, the third-order intercept is a method of measuring the linearity of an amplifier. When you're doing a third-order intercept test, you're putting in two individual carrier tones. You could do it with a single sideband transmitter by plugging two individual audio tones into the microphone, and the single sideband generator will generate two carrier terms. So in order to do the test correctly, you're putting in two carriers separated by 1 KC, 10 KC, 100 KC, there's various ways you can do it. And if you're doing it correctly, the two tones are themselves as pure as you can get. In other words, there's no mixing of the two tones of any kind, no other extraneous signals are present when you put in the two tones, and you carefully adjust the two tones at some known frequency spacing, and you carefully adjust them to be absolutely equal in amplitude. When you do that, some magic happens. Let me drop. When the two signals are exactly equal in amplitude and they're on a slightly different frequency, as a vector diagram, one has a higher frequency than the other. Therefore, if they were separated by, let me pick a number, 1 kilohertz, That means once every millisecond, because 1 kilohertz, 1 over that is a millisecond, once every millisecond, the two signals go from being in phase to being out of phase and back in phase again, because they're on a different frequency. One is really generating its carrier a little bit faster than the other. That's what the higher frequency really means. So they're going in phase, out of phase, and in phase. When they're in phase, the two voltages add, and you get a instantaneous peak power that's 6 decibels louder, or twice the voltage of any one signal. At the instant that they're out of phase, the two signals completely cancel. So on a decibel scale, compared to one individual carrier, the two-tone test is putting a complicated signal into your amplifier of the test, which is going 60 dB up and infinite dB down, and doing it cyclically. If the amplifier has complete amplitude and phase linearity, you put in these two tones, and nothing but the two tones come out. Let me drop. If your amplifier has any degree of non-linearity in amplitude or phase, in the case of tube amplifiers, usually what happens at some particular power level of the two tones going in, the peak input of 6 dB higher than any one tone starts creating overload of the amplifier, and you start getting a so-called flat top response. You start limiting at the high amplitude. Also, as you go through the two tones being out of phase for an instant, the signal is going down to zero amplitude. If the amplifier has any tendency to ring, it will be generating extraneous signals during the time it should be generating nothing. In the case of a solid-state amplifier, because you're changing the instantaneous power that goes into the amplifier, let me tell you what's going on from the amplifier's point of view. If the amplifier is sufficiently broadband, it does not see two tones. You see two tones on that spectrum analyzer because you're using an extremely narrow resolution filter that is sweeping across that screen, and it registers the first tone as it sweeps across that frequency. Let me drop. And your spectrum analyzer represents the, it measures and displays the second tone as it displays as it sweeps across that frequency. But the amplifier that you're testing, the device on the test, is broadband. It does not know there are two tones. All it knows is you're putting in this very complicated waveform that's got this butterfly-like envelope and it's got a whole bunch of carrier terms in between. That's the voltage that your amplifier sees. And it's trying to very faithfully reproduce that exotic waveform. And as you make those two tones stronger and stronger, eventually you start seeing some kind of limitation. The first signals that you see in close to your two tones are the so-called third-order intercept signals. If my two signals are separated by 1 kilohertz, in my example, let's assume that one of them is on 1 megacycle and one of them is on a kilohertz higher than 1 megacycle. As they start generating intermodulation products, because of any degree of nonlinearity in the amplifier, it starts making a Christmas tree around those two tones. The next undesirable tone will be 1 kilohertz lower than the lowest tone, and a second tone 1 kilohertz higher than the highest tone. Those are the third orders. 2 kilohertz lower than the lowest tone, and 2 kilohertz higher than the highest tone, those are the fifth orders. And so you're going to develop in close third order, fifth order, seventh orders, all the odd orders. Why are they called odd orders? Let me drop. Those so-called third-order tones, the ones that are closest to the two tones that you're putting in. The lower one is twice the frequency of the lower minus the upper. The upper close-in guy, third order, is twice the upper frequency minus the lower. So when you're taking 2 times 1 and 1 times the other, 2 and 1 equals 3, you could say mathematically that's where the third order is coming from. When you actually do the Fourier expansion and contraction, there's a little more fancy mathematics going on. But in the case of the fifth order, you're taking the third harmonic of one and the second harmonic of the other and subtracting them. And so 3 and 2 make 5, and that's one of the reasons why you can memorize them as fifth order. Every real amplifier, when you give it two tones, is always making third order, fifth order, seventh order, ninth order, and so on. It is generating all of those tones. Every real amplifier. instrumentation that you're using? And were you really sure that when you injected those two tones that you had them sufficiently isolated? Let me drop. That your instrumentation generating the two tones was not itself making third and fifth order intermods. So in order to do a two-tone test, a smart engineer will first use some kind of very exotic summing circuitry. It may be a resistor summing network. It may be a hybrid network with circulators on the two individual signal generators. By whatever means, you have to make sure that the two tones being generated going into the amplifier and the test are themselves pure. And putting your test signals into your spectrum analyzer first to confirm that there's nothing undesirable there for the first 100 decibels below those two tones, that in itself is a careful measurement requirement. Once you confirm that, you know now you're really testing the amplifier. You'd be amazed how many times people will use non-pure two tones. They didn't even know it. And when they test their amplifier, they get pessimistic results. Now, because the amplifier is generating these other undesired products, which can be measured, the magnitude of them is what you really care about. The magnitude of the undesired products, if you're smart enough, is telling you exactly what kind of nonlinearity your amplifier has. The magic of making a two-tone test, where maybe for your particular amplifier, at your particular power level where you tend to run it, let me drop, your spectrum analyzer may be able to measure the third or the fifth order tones 70, 80, 90 decibels weaker than the two tones that you're applying to the amplifier. To measure 70, 80, or 90 dB down for intermod, third order, and fifth order intermod products coming out of an amplifier with a good spectrum analyzer nowadays, relatively easy to do. The degree of nonlinearity you're measuring when you do that is probably numbers like 0001 decibels of amplitude nonlinearity. No instrumentation you can lay your hands on is going to measure directly that degree of amplitude or that degree of phase nonlinearity. It's essentially impossible. You're measuring something that's deviating in amplitude domain from such a small amount, no instrumentation could measure that for you.